Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Sorry, Mr. Grim Reaper, but I'm not ready yet. She posted on the 18th of November 2014. It starts with a quote from the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants, which goes, "Not of dying, really. It's more that I'm afraid of time and not having enough of it. Time to figure out who I'm supposed to be. To find my place in the world before I have to leave it. I'm afraid of what I'll miss." And then this is Chelsea's post. "I cried, hunched over the steering wheel in painful, racking sobs. That conversation, everything I could have, would have, should have said, but will never say, played over and over in my head at ear-splitting volume. At my auntie's funeral, her husband began his eulogy. They say grief comes in waves. Well, I was never a very good surfer, so when the waves come, I will try to do what I've always done, and that is hold my breath and wait until it passes. Sometimes the waves still throw me under, roll me over and over, threaten to drown me. Still, I want to fight against them, find the sand beneath me and kick off for the surface. But I'm learning to hold my breath, let my body loosen and be tossed for what feels like an eternity, but may only be a matter of seconds, and simply trust that soon my face will break through the cold surface and find the sun again. I will breathe deeply, grateful for this breath and the life it brings, and swim out beyond the break again."
Oh, it's so beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
Now we're just a mess.
Welcome to Just Make the Thing, a podcast for people who want to start a thing and keep on making it and are finding it tough or don't know where to start. I know it's been a while. My name is Claire Tonti. I'm really excited to bring you this interview today with Lucy Moffat, who just released her first book called Some Days, a memoir. Lucy is a listener of Just Make the Thing, and she emailed me out of the blue and I was over the moon. Two great sayings, I think, to talk to her all about how she did it and also about her story. Lucy is a lover of Dungeons and Dragons, romantic comedies and K-pop. She is also exactly what this show is all about. She's an ordinary but extraordinary human who figured out a thing she wanted to do, a story that she had to tell. And then she just went out there and did it. She wrote a book, which is, I think, something that a lot of us think we might want to do and never actually do. The catalyst for this book was her friend Chelsea, who passed away at just the age of 24 and told her to write their story. My heart broke in this interview, but I also found it strangely really, really uplifting too, and I hope you do as well. Lucy and Chelsea have a lot to teach about grabbing life by the balls for as long as we are here for, loving our people dearly while we have them, and ultimately facing the truth about ourselves and learning to love that too. Here she is, Lucy Moffat, on writing, grief, friendship and finding yourself. Hello, Lucy.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You
it's
are
so good to
welcome.
Be here.
It's so exciting to have you on Just Make the Thing. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you first, because you have written a book, Some Days, a memoir.
Yes.
Tell me, how did it come to be in the world?
Briefly, the backstory is I was an extremely weird little kid. I'd had one friend in my whole life. My brothers and sisters were much older than me, so I didn't have like any kind of social setting much growing up. And, you know, I started school and I didn't know anyone. I didn't know how to make friends. And there was this one girl in my class who everyone who knew her all agrees, like, she had this full-on aura of like energy and light that just like draws you in. And I immediately was like, I want to be friends with that girl. And so I tried to talk to her. And the first thing she said to me was, I don't want to be your friend, Freckleface.
Oh, that's so mean.
Yeah, kids are wonderful, but they can be really terrible.
Kids are horrible. Kids are horrible. I mean, I was a teacher, I know.
Yeah. And that was that, as far as I knew. But then I can't remember how this happened, but further into the term, we were talking about our birthdays, and Chelsea and I, her name is Chelsea, discovered that I'm born on the 22nd of December and she was born on the 23rd of December, 1992. And that we were born in the same hospital, and we were like the only people we knew who were born so close to Christmas. And in our five-year-old brains, that was like the craziest coincidence ever. And it was like we were astounded enough by it that it just drew us together, and we immediately became fast, fast friends. And that was the beginning of an 18-year wonderful friendship. But in high school, again, our very different kind of social personas kind of meant that we were quite separate at school. We, like, she was much more popular than me and she had tons of friends, and I wasn't like a total loser or anything, but I wasn't in her clique. And so our friendship kind of developed on like sleepovers on the weekend and school holidays and stuff. Then, like, when you leave high school, as everyone who's left high school knows, like, your social life really, really changes, and we didn't really see much of each other for a couple of years. But then around our 21st birthdays, we started spending a lot more time together, and I realised how much I'd missed her and how great it is to be in her company. And so we started spending a lot more time together. And tragically, a couple of months later, she was diagnosed with very, very rare, very, very aggressive form of cancer. And so began a very different aspect of our friendship. And I kind of intuited very quickly that she would need someone and I could be that person. And I wanted to be that person because if, you know, the worst should happen, I wouldn't be able to live with myself if I had not been there when I could. So we, after having like our whole lives been kind of distantly friends but emotionally very close, I started visiting her every week, and we spent huge amounts of time together and, you know, talked about all aspects of life for the 2 and a bit years that she was sick. In 2016, I went to study abroad in South Korea. And when I visited her before I left, she was really like, oh, let's not talk about cancer. Like, let's talk about anything else. I'm fine. Go have a great holiday and tell me all about it. And 3 weeks later, she was gone.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was alone studying abroad in South Korea when I got the call from her sister that she'd passed away, and I was 4 days away from coming home. Yeah. When she passed. So somehow I got myself back to Adelaide and she wasn't there anymore. And like, it was, I had lost people before, but never someone that I'd loved so dearly. And that even though she'd been sick, I'd never really let myself fully entertain the possibility that I would lose her. And so I was just completely blindsided. And
so did you know she was that close to passing away when you left?
No, I didn't. The only thing she said was, oh, like, it's been shit at the hospital. I don't want to talk about it. Yeah, like, and pretty soon after I left, things took a huge turn for the worse. But she didn't tell me initially. She so wanted me to like be having great adventures and enjoying myself that she didn't want to tell me because she didn't want me to come home early. And by the time she did, I still, like, it just wasn't passing through my brain fast enough. And then it like suddenly changed, and then it was all over. Yeah.
That's so huge.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the book really came out of me just trying to get my head around what had happened and trying to process the grief that I'd never felt before. Like, I had no idea how massive it would be. And that also the desire to like preserve my memories of her, because I knew, you know, eventually I'm not going to forget, but I'm not going to be thinking about it 24 hours a day forever. And so really it just started as like a Word document diary where I just word vomited out everything I was thinking and feeling and slowly reworked it into something readable.
Did she know you were going to write a book?
Yeah. So as I said on the cover, I've got a quote from her. She always had this kind of sense of humour about her that she was like, oh, well, you know, like I could write to Channel 10 and like get put on like a renovation show or something and like get or win a free holiday or something, like sell my story. But I don't want to do that because I want you to write about it. And I want my story told by you. And she was always like, oh, then you can make us both famous. And I remember when after she was diagnosed, but before she was having chemotherapy, and she was still quite able to do stuff. And for a while, her life wasn't that different. We were planning to write like a web series that was, we were going to have like a sitcom that's like two friends.
Me and my dying friend.
Yeah, exactly. Like try to, because she was so always funny about it. Like she was always making light of the situation. And we thought we could have made quite a funny show of like two housemates, one of whom has cancer and the other one has mental illness, which I still think is a good idea. And I hope someone else writes it. I don't think I can be quite as funny about it anymore though.
I know, because that's the huge thing, isn't it? There's an idea of writing a story about your friend, but she's not a character.
No.
She's a person in your life that you obviously loved so much.
Mm.
What did she teach you about things?
Yeah. Life? The biggest one that really shone through when I was in Korea and I just found out that she'd passed away, there was this sense of like, I describe it to a lot of people as like I could see very clearly that there were two paths. I could run away from it and I could, you know, take drugs or whatever to try and dull the pain, or I could open myself up to it. I could take a deep breath, turn around and face it. And I think what Chelsea always showed me was that there's strength in opening yourself up and there's strength in turning towards the light, letting love in and giving love in any way you can. And yeah, and I remember having this almost voice in my head being like, just Chelsea loved the world. You know, she loved people. She loved traveling. She loved creativity. Like she was so open to everything that life has to offer. Do that.
Like, yeah.
Open up, let it all in, let it all out. And like when you can, find the joke.
Yeah. What was her funeral like?
Oh, my God, she would have loved her funeral.
Wouldn't we all like to say that?
Yeah. It's like if anyone was going to have a funeral, like it was the dream funeral. They had the biggest chapel at the like biggest funeral home in Adelaide, and every seat was full. There were people spilling out the doors. There were people, there were like two levels. There were people lined up all up the stairs. It was completely full. I think almost every single person from our year level turned up, and I think her Facebook page got over 1,000 posts after she passed away, just of love and sharing memories with her. And everybody had unique memories of her because she touched everyone she ever came across in some vivid way. She had this beautiful white coffin with gold handles covered in exquisite flowers. And it was a really, really beautiful ceremony. Yeah, it was a really beautiful day. And
what was it like for you?
It was such a jumble, the funeral, because it was this beautiful setting. It was amazing that so many people were there. People were sharing really lovely words with me, and I spoke at the funeral. I gave part of her eulogy. And so I kind of had to hold it together because I knew I would be speaking. So I kept it together. I sat with her family during the initial part of the ceremony. But the moment I came off the stage, I just crumpled into my partner's arms and there was this amazing slideshow of photos of her. But I have almost no memory of it because I was just a mess. And then at the end, my fiancé and I kind of went out to find like a private spot and we just kind of held each other and cried. And once that wave passed, you know, people started coming up to me and speaking with me and sharing their memories again. And that was really lovely. As I sort of said, that Chelsea always had this attitude that there's always something positive, there's always something you can enjoy in any situation. And there were parts of her funeral like that. you know.
Yeah, weirdly, sometimes funerals are incredibly amazing experiences to be in.
Yeah,
which sounds really morbid.
It does, but then there are so few situations where you are, everyone around you is being their most vulnerable and their most open.
Yeah, because you're all so close to that understanding, and I want to ask you about that too.
Mm.
We all die.
Like
our lives finish.
Yeah.
So has it changed your view of death?
Completely. I think because of my age, I suppose, and because of the privileged position. I'm 26 now. 26. So I was 23 when she passed away. And because I'm a privileged person, I've grown up in a very privileged setting. Like I, of course, knew that death happened, but I didn't understand what it really is. You know, I'd never really seen it happen. And I had no idea how profound loss is. And that even at that time when everything around you is full of life and growth and there's nothing but future ahead of you, that can go away. That changes and in many, many different ways. But this was just the way that Chelsea experienced it and I experienced it.
For me, when I lost my dad, it was the fragility of it.
Yes.
Like you suddenly feel like you're walking on the edge of a cliff.
Yeah, totally.
And everyone else is just ordering lattes and like at Coles, buying milk. And you're like, don't you know you could fucking die any day?
Yeah. Don't you get it?
Exactly.
I sort of mentioned this in the book that the day that Chelsea passed away, I went for a walk through Seoul. Seoul is it's an awesome city. It's an exciting city, but it can be incredibly lonely place. And I was like walking through this park and I had that moment of, I was like seeing, you know, teenagers like kicking a soccer ball around or like couples on their first date or like women like chasing their kids around.
It's like a montage.
And it was like this like perfect sunny autumn day. And I was like, I felt like there was almost like a glass wall between me and everybody else because all I could think about was death, but there was life everywhere around me. And I remember kind of thinking like, oh, in movies and books and stuff, people hate that. They get really angry about that feeling and they want to shake everyone around them. But for me, it was more like, even though right now all I'm thinking about is death and loss, there's so much more to life. You know, like there's so much more around, and eventually I will experience that as well again. But before I lost Chelsea, they were completely separate things. Life and death were totally separate. Now they're a lot more interwoven, I suppose.
Yeah, you sort of, it's like that whole idea, it sounds cliched, that you can't understand or fully embrace light without understanding what darkness is.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, we're really getting Oprah here. But I do think that it colours, understanding that our lives are final and have an ending, whatever that ending, whenever it happens, colours your life with this kind of technicolour. You kind of lean into like the chocolate brownie or the experience of being with the people that you love.
Yeah,
more.
Definitely. And I think, and you're so much more conscious that the choices you make matter, you know, like there's a limited amount of time. Life could be really short. It could be really long. So it's important that way too. You want to be doing something you care about.
Yeah. And then, so then you get to I'm going to write a book. Because I know you talk about in the book, you've always wanted to be a writer.
Yeah.
And it was something that's been there for you from a very young age.
Yeah.
And wanting to create. And I think sometimes when we label ourselves anyway as odd, as kids.
Yeah.
You become a bit of an outsider in that you can then observe things from a different standpoint maybe.
Mm.
How do you then, because that's a lot of pressure to be like, everything matters. I'm going to write a memoir about the most extraordinary heartbreaking thing that ever happened to me. Did the words just flow and it was cathartic?
Mm.
Did you have moments where you were like, I don't want to do this?
Yeah. Well, the first thing was that this was the first time I set out to do something without the end goal in mind. Like I've always been a very future-oriented, very ambitious person and I have wanted to be a writer my whole life. And so I have set out to write books before, but I always got in my own way and my fears of failure or rejection or whatever would always stop me from following through. So with this one, I approached with a completely different mindset. Initially, it was, like I said, it was really just a diary and I couldn't think about anything else. So I had to write about it. You know, I had to get the thoughts and the feelings and the words out of me because I felt like otherwise I could never move forward. And so that first draft, I don't even know if I can call it a draft because it was like, I don't know, 30,000 words or something and was really just a mess of feelings on the page, was very easy to write. It happened in, I wrote it in a few months because whenever I was alone, it was all I was thinking about. And so I'd come home from work and I could either sit on the couch staring at the wall, feeling awful and thinking about this, or I could make something from it. So that's what I did. And then I sort of wrote, I felt like that was all I had to say about it, but it still wasn't letting me go. I think the initial impulse to just write anything had kind of morphed into more of a solid idea that had kind of sunk its claws into me, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't not write it anymore. So then I opened a new fresh Word document and I started typing it all from scratch again with a much more structured mindset for it. That took longer because I was focusing a lot more on the sentences and the words and the intention behind it. But it's still probably less than 6 months it took me. When I finished that draft, I suddenly had this brainwave and I thought, I think this could be a book. Like, it's not a book yet, but there's actually a lot in here that isn't only meaningful for me, you know, like that I'm not the first person in the world to have ever lost someone important to them. And I remembered the strong feelings I've had many times in my life, but especially when Chelsea was diagnosed and when she passed away, of like, what can I turn to? You know, I've always turned to pop culture to kind of show me how to do things that I don't know how to do. But there isn't a book about that. Or there isn't a TV show about that. And so I'm sure other people feel that way. I'm sure other people have these moments when they feel completely alone and they're not necessarily. You know, we all experience this stuff. It's just so rare to talk about it. So I wanted to rework it into something potentially publishable. And that was when I changed the narrative voice from me writing about Chelsea to me addressing her directly. And that's when I included her writing as well. So she kept a blog while she was sick and wrote about her experience and her optimism and her hope for recovery. So I include in the book posts and passages from that blog. Yeah, so I rewrote it addressing her and kind of treated it more as one last conversation between us, because that was really the definitive thing in our friendship all the way through, but particularly in the final few years of her life, that we just lay in her bed with like Bold and the Beautiful on in the background and just talked all day without stopping. And that's the thing that I most often miss. Like just those like long winding conversations where we would switch from just like total bullshit to very big, important stuff quite seamlessly and back again.
Mm. Did you talk about God? Or a belief in what happens after death?
I think she particularly, and I share this, found the structure of organized religion really impossible. And we went to the same private Christian high school, and the kind of authoritative male version of God never held any real meaning for us. And I think as well as she got sicker, the thought of God and religion kind of came to be associated for her with inevitability of death, because when she was really, really sick in hospital, they would send a chaplain to talk to her and she was always like, get out, I'm not talking to you. So we talked about that part of it, that struggle I still have with authoritative organized religion. For her, I remember once her saying, you know, like, it's like death is not going to be bad for me. Like, why would I? I'm not going to care. I'm going to be dead. Like, she had this very like pragmatic mindset about it. And I think for her, it probably represented just a total removal from the physical pain that she experienced every day of her illness, but also just the emotional pain of living. Death would be like a complete
relief.
And I think that's what I've embraced of that when I imagine her now, I imagine her in that state. And the chapter in my book that's about, I say it as God, but what I really mean is organized religion, was written quite early when I was, my grief was so angry and the kind of implication that I'd had that God would be, would help and would be a respite just didn't have, hold any meaning for me because it didn't feel like there was any respite. I don't feel, I'm not so angry now. I don't feel so strongly anymore, but I still, I don't think I can ever reconcile the injustice of her loss with the idea of an all-loving, all-knowing and all-caring God. I just can't see how those two things match for me. Mm. And I think she felt the same when we talked about it.
That's huge. Mm. Yeah. What do you think about energy? Because I know you said in the book that you felt her still with you, though.
Yeah, and particularly very initially, like when she first passed away, I had dreams about her that were so vivid all the time. And I still occasionally do, like, make a comment like I would say to her and can almost feel her response. And I remember holding on to this feeling when she first died, or this thought of, you know, that energy doesn't die, energy transfers, matter dies, but energy doesn't increase or decrease ever. It just moves between avenues, I suppose. That's not a scientific way of putting it, but that's how it is in my brain. And I took a lot of comfort in that, the feeling that that enormous, vivacious life force that was her still exists in some other form, not as her anymore, but as something, was a huge comfort. Mm.
Maya Angelou and Oprah, well, Oprah talks about the idea that when someone passes, their energy is then up there somewhere in the universe, mm, kind of on your team.
Yeah, helping I you. Like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I really like that mindset. And I've definitely had moments when I thought, oh, I feel like
up
that.
There
I feel like
along.
That had a little bit of Chelsea's kind of humor to it. Or if she was organizing this, this is exactly how it would have gone. Or something.
Yeah. Tell me about the sunflowers.
Yeah.
They're on the front of your book.
Yeah.
Too.
So they're on the front of the book. There's several reasons for that. In a purely literary sense, sunflowers have always represented kind of the persistence of joy. Like they've got those really strong stems that can hold up these huge heads. And so they represent, yeah, strength, but also loyalty. And of course, that's a that's a huge aspect of friendship and huge aspect of our friendship is loyalty. There's also the fact that maybe I'm just talking about me, but I think most people would agree that it's almost impossible to not feel better if you're looking at a bunch of sunflowers. They just trigger hopeful, joyful feelings just to look at them. And that happened for me that the day Chelsea died, as I said, I went for a walk around Seoul and I was wandering completely aimlessly. I had no idea where to go and I was just walking the streets. And I turned around a corner and right in front of me was this house that just had a row of sunflowers in full bloom out the front. And I had like tears streaming down my face during the walk and I just stopped and I laughed out loud because it was such a bright, optimistic, hopeful and joyful image that it was just undeniable. And I felt, and it gave me this feeling that Chelsea's presence used to give me of just energy and possibility and optimism and hope for the future that even though in that moment I was as low and as dark as I could possibly be, I knew that eventually I would be okay. You know, eventually I would be happy again. And I couldn't help but feel like the total coincidences that had led me to that moment and the fact that they already existed. It's not like they grew out of nothing just because I needed to see sunflowers.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But just the serendipity of it had a feeling of inevitability and like maybe she'd pushed me to walk in that direction.
Yeah, well, because sunflowers tend to the sun, right?
Yeah.
They follow the
light. Yeah, they do. They do follow the light. And that's, it's just such a beautiful symbol and it's so like her to do that. The other thing was, I don't write about this in the book, but the friend I sent the book to first read it, like when I finished the third draft, she read it in like a few hours. And she called me and she was like, oh my God, last night when you finished the book, I had a dream that Chelsea was standing in a park holding a sunflower. Whoa. Yeah. Yeah. Like that's wild. And yeah. I don't have an answer for that.
I just think the world is way more magical and much bigger than we can possibly comprehend or understand.
Yeah, and I'm happy for that to be the way it is. You know, I don't need to understand it. I'm just going to behold it and be in awe of it.
In the book you talk about Patton Oswalt's quote, the comedian who lost his wife really tragically.
Really tragically.
And he says at the end of his Netflix special, "It's chaos, be kind." Mm. What do you love about that quote?
I find so much comfort in the thought that it's just chaos. I understand why people feel better to think that there's order to the universe and that there's a sense of balance, but I can't see that. And for a long time, I really struggled with that feeling of, is there something wrong with me? Why can't I see it? Or if there's a sense of balance, but Chelsea died, what does that say about Chelsea? You know, like I just couldn't wrap my head around it. But then I had this moment of like, what if there is no balance? What if good things happen to good things happen to bad things happen to good people, and bad things happen to bad people, and it's all just random? Maybe it's super morbid, but to me that's really nice. Like, because it means you can expect good and bad, and you can prepare for good and bad, and you can be hopeful but also find strength when you need to. And that's the chaos side of that. The be kind side to me is just that's the power we do have. If it is all chaos, why be good? Because it's better. Like, that if it is all chaos, there's no reward for being kind, then it's even better to be kind. And, and that just, I heard it at the right moment when I was grappling with this inability to resolve what I was feeling and thought, oh, that's good. Yeah, it's chaos, be kind. That's ideal.
Yeah, well, you never know what someone else is walking through.
Yeah.
When you bump into them and they swear at you at the supermarket or something. Yeah. I use a lot of supermarket analogies today. You know, our immediate response can be, oh, bloody hell.
Yeah.
Or, oh, God, that person, it was annoying or frustrating. Yeah. But you don't know what's going on behind that person who beeps at you at the lights or whatever.
I
love that idea, be kind. My friend Ellen from another podcast we do called The Millennial Divide talks about assume good intentions.
Yeah, that's nice.
And I like that too.
Yeah.
Though not everybody has good intentions.
No, but they're just part of the chaos as well.
Yeah, correct. And I do really like that.
Yeah.
You just spoke about waves and I want to ask you more about grief because to me that's how I experienced it in these huge all-encompassing waves and then you're fine again.
Yeah.
What have you done to work through those waves?
Yeah, I outline in the book or mention in the book that just less than a year after Chelsea passed away, one of my aunties died very suddenly. She had a stroke and she was quite young. She was very healthy. It came completely out of the blue. And her husband at her funeral started by saying, "My grief comes in waves and I was never a very good surfer. So when that happens, please excuse me. I'm just going to take a breath and wait for it to pass." And that's all you can do. Well, it was all I could do was just take a deep breath, sit quietly and allow it to pass, you know, not trying to fight for the surface, not trying to run away from it, as I said, just knowing that right now that's happening, but sometime in the future it won't be happening. So I'm just going to sit here while it's happening and trust that I'll breathe again, you know. And that was hard because I'm a fighter and I've always been a fighter, and I wanted to do anything I could to not feel how I was feeling. But again, there was just this bit of me, whether it's an instinct or something I'd read or something I'd learned from Chelsea, was just to keep breathing and wait it out and trust.
Mm. It strikes me too that in your 26 years, you've had a lot of life experiences other than Chelsea passing away too. Do you want to tell me a little bit about what you write about sexuality in the book?
When I first wrote it, I was only going to write about my and Chelsea's friendship. But as I was writing, I was realizing that a lot of this stuff was interconnected and that my growing up had happened in these different ways and they were all relevant. And again, they could all be important for someone else who read it. And so I do touch on my bisexuality, which I only really woke up to well into my 20s, when I was already with the man that I'm going to marry, and I will take those vows very seriously. But bisexuality has always been a part of me, always will be a part of me. And those feelings affected relationships in ways that I couldn't understand while they were happening, because I was forcing myself to remain blind to what those feelings meant. And like, I reread old diaries from middle school and high school, and I can see myself forcing myself away from that realization.
Of having feelings for girls in your class or
with feelings I had for friends, and just that identity in itself as well. That, and I don't even know where that shame came from, because I've never lived in a homophobic world. Like, my parents are not homophobic. No one in my family is. One of my aunts is a lesbian, and that's never been a cause of contention. I don't know where the shame came from, but it was so strong for so long that I remember the day I realized that I was bisexual. And I just remember this wave of relief. Like, oh my God, that's what that is. Like, that's what those feelings were.
That's right. So you'd have really, like, intense friendships.
Yeah, I would have these really, really intense friendships, and they'd be so wonderful and positive, and then all of a sudden they would not be anymore, and they would change quite dramatically, and I would end up being really, really hurt. And that pattern repeated itself for years with lots of different girls. And I never understood why. And I always thought, there must be something wrong with me. I'm too full on. I've got these big feelings and I demand too much, so I have to cram that down. I have to be less. But no matter how much I crammed that down, it kept happening. And it wasn't until I woke up to my own sexuality that, well, from that day forward, I've had nothing but positive female friendships. Because I'm so much more aware of the direction my feelings go in. And I guess I protect myself better as well. But, yeah, God, it was a huge relief.
Well, the more you know yourself, right,
yes,
the easier you walk through life. Like, that's why you write in the book too about how aging is actually such a wonderful – I mean, we say that now, oh, my God.
Yeah, like,
I am 26. Being enough 50s and be like,
we were such idiots.
Now my boobs are at my knees, you know, or whatever it is.
I can't wait to be in my 50s.
But, I mean, there is a certain point. I've heard some women talk about how that it's almost a release for having to fit into some kind of male idea of attractiveness or whatever it is, that it's quite freeing once you hit that point. And I don't know what it'll be like, but there is something wonderful. The more that you know yourself, you know your body, you know what you need, the more you enjoy life, because you avoid the things that you know aren't good for you.
Yes.
You've put food in your body that you know makes you feel good, but then it's conversely also you protect yourself better.
Yeah.
You put yourself parameters around yourself.
Yeah. You you recognize the boundaries and you maintain them. Like,
yes,
that's amazing.
Correct.
That's like a totally new thing for me. In like 3 years, I've learned
really
how to do that.
It's really exciting. I mean, I'm 33. It only gets better, mate.
Yeah, I
for
can't wait.
Example, I have realized I am terrible with time.
Yeah.
And this is so nowhere near as life changing as understanding your own sexuality. However, I'm going to go with it and show you anyway.
I want to hear it.
Yeah. So I realized that some people just like people aren't very good with, say, spatial awareness, and I'm not really good with that either.
Mm.
Or some people lean towards literacy sort of stuff. Some people are more math, science orientated, whatever it is.
Yeah.
I am terrible with spatial awareness and also time. And
yep.
It comes hand in hand. And I read this study that actually that is an actual thing that people aren't good at.
Mm.
And once I understood that, now whenever I have to get to somewhere on time,
yeah,
I ask my husband, can I feasibly do this, all these things, and get to this place by this time? And he's like, definitely not.
That's so good. And then you can stop blaming yourself. You can stop being like, I'm such an idiot.
Yes.
I can't keep – like, I can't control time,
yeah,
or I can't maintain good friendships with women in my case. It's not about your personal failure. It's just who you are. It's just what happens.
Yeah, it's a quirk of your personality
or
a part of who you are. And once you understand that, you can put in boundaries.
Yeah.
You can, like, and then
and you can
practice.
Recognize when those patterns are happening and you can do something about it.
Yeah.
Rather than just seeing it through until the inevitable end.
Yeah, when you're an hour late and you've, like, for my case, when you're an hour late and you're mortified and stressed and, like, crying in the car because you have this, like, adrenaline thing going on where you can't and you don't understand how you managed to be late when you had all the time in the world. And I guess I think that's what is so lovely about aging.
Mm.
You touched on shame before.
Yeah.
From your childhood, and you write about your father and the impact of him on your life. Do you want to talk us through a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I'll preface by saying I have, like, the two best parents ever. My dad is an absolute hero, angel, and my mom is a fierce, like, the most loving person in the whole world. They, as all people are flawed and have made mistakes in their life. They met very late in life. My dad was married and had two children who were kind of teenage. My mom also had a son, but she was a single parent when they met. And my dad's marriage was already breaking down when they got together and mum fell pregnant with me. And that obviously sped things along. And dad's life changed very suddenly, completely changed. They have been absolutely devoted to me, but my position in the family is strange because of that. My next older sibling's 12 years older than me, and inevitably there has been resentment towards my mom and me, because I think particularly when I was a baby and a small child, I really represented my parents' mistakes and what had happened. And I picked up on that because kids are sensitive and you can't hide stuff from kids. As much as adults think that they can, you can't. But I didn't understand it. I didn't know, you know, your parents are just your parents. Like, I didn't know the context for it. And so as a little kid, I just knew that these random women that I would meet hated me and I didn't know why. And that has continued into adulthood, that occasionally still I will be somewhere with my dad and we'll run into a woman, and it's always a woman, who looks at me with this first confusion, but then it kind of turns very cold. And in the book I describe it as I can almost see the word illegitimate child, like, run through her eyes. And so I grew up with this feeling of, like, I don't fit into this normal family. And then there's my dad and my mum and me, particularly me, tacked on the edge of a family. And that turned into a very, very deep, profound sense of shame that I still couldn't place. And so it was just kind of a part of me. And so shame has always been a very present emotion in my life, and it often is the first response I have to things. And I think that plays a role in why it took me so long to come to terms with my own sexuality, was that that dense automatic response of shame kind of clouded over so many parts of my identity. I wrote the chapter about that in a furious rush. I'd been with my dad at an art exhibition opening, and the artist did that thing of looking at me, figuring out who I am and where I'm placed, and then doing everything she could to kind of talk to my dad but shove me out. And it's like this almost like adolescent girl thing. And
is that because she was friends with his wife?
Yeah, well, or? She was friends with dad, I think, but knew him as married to his then wife. And that was the context for their friendship. And I think for a lot of people, it's just like if your sense of where things are placed gets muddled, you kind of respond in a very negative way.
So weird, isn't it? Because yeah. It's actually nothing to do with you.
Yeah.
It's everything to do with your parents.
Yeah. But,
or your dad.
Yeah, yeah. But that I always felt that it was always targeted at me and my mum. And she experiences it as well. Yeah, so I wrote this chapter in a furious wave, and I almost didn't include it because I've never talked about it. Like, I've never talked about it to my family, and I still, like, even right now, I'm like, how do I say this?
Without offending everybody.
Yeah, yeah. Because everybody I'm talking about are people I genuinely love and who, as I've grown up, increasingly have accepted me and treated me as family.
Did your mom and dad then get together, or did it?
Yes, yeah, so they're still together. Okay. They have been happily unmarried for like 30 years now.
Okay.
And that's kind of part of, like, my mom has said to me before, like, we've been together longer than dad was ever with his ex-wife. Like, yeah. But I'm still treated as this, like, extra other woman in some ways. And I don't know, it's a very unusual situation. I've never met anyone else who's experienced that specifically the way I have, which again is part of why I decided to include it, because I thought, I'm sure other people have felt this. There has to be.
Do you think that your dad gets off a lot more lightly in the whole thing?
Yeah, I think it's something he and I still really need to talk about properly as adults. He, in an external way, yes, in the sense of like how people will talk to him, people from his past will talk to him perfectly friendly and very not friendly to my mum and me. However, when he read that chapter, he was like, I know exactly what you mean about shame. You know, he feels it on the same level that we do and has been, rather than working through his own shame about it, has been supporting everybody else through it, you know?
Like, yeah.
And that's him. Like, he, my God, will be there for others to the end of the earth, completely forgetting himself.
Yeah.
And I think as much as on the outside he's not punished for it the way that perhaps we have been, I think the shame inside is just as profound.
Yeah, just different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's an amazingly old-fashioned gender dynamic that I see of, like, the illegitimate child thing, that, like, who would think that that's still something people care about, but I can say with authority that they do.
Wow.
Yeah.
It is so interesting. Yeah, yeah, there's the sort of the thing, I sometimes think there's the things that people say about what they believe.
Yes.
And then there's the internalized subconscious attitudes that they've held from whatever cultural references, the way that they grew up, their religion, their family background, culture, society in general, that, you know, I guess it's the same with sexism and racism.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the surface, most people would like to say that they weren't any of those things. But there's a lot of internalized stuff that comes out. I mean, I find that even in myself sometimes.
Yeah, totally.
You know, and I think women particularly, for a lot of reasons, have lived in a society that's quite patriarchal. And so we ourselves have reactions to things and often, I think, hold women, other women up to a much higher standard and kind of go, oh, well, he's a guy. He doesn't really get it.
Yeah, totally.
You know, he can't help himself.
Yeah, you can always excuse male behavior, but God, women should know better.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It is so interesting. So what have you done to unpack? Because obviously you talked about mental health too.
Yeah.
Do you see psychologists? Do you have strategies in place to kind of help you with all of that?
I should see a psychologist and I want to find one.
Mate, you've been through so much. What are you doing? It's okay. This has been like a welcome to my couch therapy session.
Yeah, and that's kind of like, I think for a lot of people, that's conversation with me as well. I'm kind of, it's like welcome to my couch.
Yeah.
But for me, it's always been writing, you know, and like all my diaries are full of almost like essays because I sort of have always sat down to write about what I'm feeling and I don't stop until I reach some kind of resolution. Like, and so I've always kind of not done it on my own in the sense that like no one's ever helped me because I've had plenty of help, but I tend to prefer to work through stuff at sort of with curiosity. I guess I approach it with like, what is this about? And where is it coming from? What is it affecting? How can I resolve it? Which I'm sure is what would happen if I went to therapy as well.
No,
but I tend
that
to do
genuinely
it.
Genuinely, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just your own voice talking until you solve yourself.
Yeah.
And then you pay someone like $150.
Yeah.
So you've just found a way to do it for free.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then also create art out of it.
Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah. But yeah, there definitely have been moments where I'm like, man, I would really like to have a professional person in my corner who could like tell me what to do right now. But I just haven't. Like, I'm like that about like doctors as well. I just put it off forever.
Even though it's so unhealthy. What happened to Chelsea as well?
Yeah, I don't know why not. It's not like any opposition to it. I just never got my act together and saw someone.
Life is hard. There's no time.
Yeah,
there's no time for anything.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There's no time.
No,
I have a book to write.
Exactly. Had a book to write, you had a cover to design.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. No time. And getting engaged.
Yeah.
Oh, tell me how you got engaged.
Oh,
tell
it's a good story. It's a good story. So last year, my partner and I were living in Japan. We did a working holiday and lived in Tokyo. And while we were there, we really wanted to climb Mount Fuji. So we set aside a few days to do that. And we arrived, you start like halfway up the mountain at like midday, and we climbed until about 5 p.m. and then stayed overnight in a mountain hut. And it's like one room with like this massive bed where like 30 people sleep. And we slept there until like midnight, and then we got up and climbed the rest of the way so that we could arrive at sunrise. And when we got to the top, the sun hadn't quite risen yet, so we kind of walked around for a while and sat down. And then Jordan said, oh, just like stand there. I'm going to go ask someone to take our photo. And the sun was coming up. We were like at the top of Mount Fuji and surrounded by clouds. And then, yeah, he got down on one knee. And there's very low oxygen at the top of Mount Fuji. So I was like, and he was like, oh, stop, you need to breathe. Like, calm down. So he proposed at the top of Mount Fuji, which was very, very spectacular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it was very, very nice.
I love it. Oh, gosh. Okay, well, happy congratulations.
Thank you.
For getting married and all those things. And what's the surface like now?
The surface is beautiful. My life has become what I always hoped it would be and didn't know if I could expect. I'm getting married to an amazing person, and I wrote a book, and it's real.
It's here.
It's
I know.
Here. I can hold it. I can see it on a shelf. It's real. It's unbelievable. I'm surrounded by incredible people. You know, when Chelsea first died, I felt like I'd lost my only friend in the world. But, oh, my God, the way that the women around me stepped up and have been there, and they're all glorious women.
I'm so lucky to be surrounded by the people I have. My family are wonderful. My friends are beautiful. My partner is a superhero. And, you know, there'll be times that won't be wonderful, but right now the surface is beautiful.
What advice would you give to someone out there who has a thing that they want to write or make or do and they're stuck?
Enjoy what you're doing and do it because you enjoy it. Even if it's, I mean, despite the subject matter, writing this book was a joy because writing is a joy for me. That was the reason to write it. I mean, this bit is awesome. Having the book is amazing, but if that was the reason I was doing it, I don't think I ever would have finished it. Enjoy what you're doing. Do it because you enjoy it. And that's enough. If that's enough, you've won. Even if it's you never publish or even if you never win an award, whatever, if you love doing it, that's plenty.
Yeah, it's that curiosity, right?
Yeah.
But don't take it too seriously.
Yeah, because life is short, so you want to make something, but life could be really long, so you should enjoy making it.
Yeah. Give it a burl.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be good.
No, not at all. Oh, my God. It could be awful and it could never see the light of day, but if you love making it, it's worth making.
Absolutely. Okay, well, congratulations. And your book is certainly not terrible. It's great. It's really great. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And I hope I want to see some more.
Yeah, me too.
Have you got plans?
Yeah, it'll be very different. I'm very tired of myself as a subject. I don't think I've got to write more memoir. Probably fiction. I hope fiction because I miss fiction.
Fine.
Yeah.
Building wheels in your head.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Lucy Moffat.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for just making the thing and getting this book into the world. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's huge.
It's
so huge. Awesome. I've said huge a lot today. But getting something you have thought about for a long time and then becoming it and having it in your hands, I can't even imagine the joy that must, the satisfaction.
Yeah. It's such a joy. And I'm just so glad that I did what my instincts were telling me to do, what Chelsea told me to do, and made something beautiful out of something terrible. And, you know, I wish she was here to see it, but maybe she is.
Sure, she's around somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to a podcast called Just Make the Thing with me, Claire Tonti, and this week with Lucy Moffat. Her book, Some Days, a Memoir, can be found at all good bookstores and online. She's also speaking at Mitcham Library on Wednesday the 22nd of May at 6:30 p.m. So you can go and check her out there too if you're around in South Australia. Okay, I love doing this podcast because I get to talk to some really incredible creatives. And if you scroll back through my feed, you'll find interviews with Claire Bowditch, with Will Anderson, with Luke McGregor and Celia Pocola, and lots of other incredible writers and podcasters as well from around the Planet Broadcasting Network, which incidentally is a podcast network that I run with my husband, man, James. And you can find out more about that at planetbroadcasting.com. And if you want some stories from me, I'm doing a little bit less social media at the moment because, I don't know, is it good for our mental health? I'm not sure. But if you would like to follow me, I would love to hear from you over at Claire Tonti on Instagram and Facebook. And you can email the show at justmakethethingpod@gmail.com if you would like to tell me something or share something with me, or if you are someone who has made a thing that you would like to talk to our audience about. That would be brilliant. Please leave a review if you like the show. We would love you to do that. And you can listen for free through Apple Podcasts and subscribe there. Go on. Okay. Have a great week, guys. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Hmm. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.